Welcome back to the 9 till noon show. Good morning if you have just joined us. We had a great Friday panel, lots of conversation, dominated, I suppose, with 1 week to go, and it's perhaps our last big hurrah on the presidential election. The conversation dominated by it, and your comments the same. Nobody should vote for any politician, says a listener, who advocates abortion or euthanasia because he would be as guilty as them for murdering the innocent. Another, I cannot in all consciousness vote for any candidate or any of the candidates, and the only way I can exercise my right is to spoil my vote. In this election, spoiled votes just demonstrate people's disgust in the government. Corrupt method of selection. And others are saying spoiling your vote does not mean it's not counted. It is. Of course it is, but it's counted as a percentage, and there's always a percentage of spoiled votes. And then next thing you know, you're trying to explain that we've achieved something by 8% of votes being spoiled, but what have you achieved when someone is elected and the person you're opposed to perhaps wins or comes second? You know, like, so I get where you're coming from, and it is anyone's right to do it. I just don't see the logic of it. I'm not trying to convince people not to do it or to do it. I'm just saying I don't, because I've covered an awful lot of elections. I know where the focus is at, and spoiled votes, they're a big deal in a council election where it can be very tight and all that kind of stuff, but in a national election, it doesn't really matter if they're 10%. It doesn't send any meaningful message. But that's just my view, and it's an honest view. Let's see. It is condescending of the panel to say it's futile to spoil your vote. That's the reason why large numbers will spoil their vote. We have a voice, and we will no longer be dictated to by the elite politicians in this country. This country has given us a choice between an Orange Order candidate and a communist candidate. How is that a choice? Well, that's quite an interesting framing. But also, you framed them as elite, you know, and Maria Steen is a very wealthy person. She is elite as well, you could say. So if it's about elitism, I didn't really see a non-elite big name in the hat. But anyway, hi, Greg. Just wondering, if none of the three candidates running for election are favourable to me, what am I supposed to do on election day? Who do I vote for? Well, you know, you stay at home, I suppose, or go and spoil your vote if you wanted to spoil your vote. But there's lots and lots of people that none of the three or the two that are actively campaigning, that people won't vote because they don't feel that person represents them, or it doesn't really matter because there's not someone there that they feel represents them. So people will either not vote, which probably, you know, 65% of people will not vote. That's, you know, so we're going to have effectively a president likely elected by, well, what percentage? So say the winner gets, you know, 40% of 35%, right? So we're going to be effectively having 16% of the population electing the next president, something along those lines, you know, so it's hard to get too excited about. That's probably be we're at 16-17% of the population electing the next the voting population, sorry, electing the next president. It's why I can't get too excited about it, but I have a rule here. Greg said it would be different if we live in a dictatorship. I feel that we are in a dictatorship, and Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil do whatever they want. Why would Catherine Connolly not answer a question from Enoch Burke's brother? She should have answered him, as she's an ex-barrister. I won't be voting for Catherine or Heather. I saw that video clip, and I mean, obviously, you know which angle the Burkes are going to come at. But anyway, it's up to her. We don't live in a dictatorship because you all went out and voted last year, and or was it earlier this year? Last year, and you voted in big enough numbers for Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil to go back into government again together. You know, the electorate nor the left organised to put an alternative in there. That's not a dictatorship. That's literally how democracy works. You would be wasting your time going to vote for a president who's going to do nothing for you and will be kept in a big fancy house by taxpayers' money. We don't need a doll, and we don't need a prime minister, as everything is controlled by the EU anyway. A complete waste of your time and money, says the listener. For God's sakes, Catherine Connolly is standing for president of Ireland, not Syria. What's this character assassination about? Who is the conservative woman talking? It's Grainne Hines, it's her view. Good morning, Greg. I'll be voting Catherine Connolly. Such a lovely, pleasant woman. That other one is not as nice, says Danny. Danny, you'll appreciate me moderating the language a little bit, I hope. What do we need a president for? It's just a sham of a job, full stop. Do away with it altogether, says another listener. Another, I don't understand how someone thinks that Heather Humphreys will be a united voice for Ireland. Is Heather not married to a Presbyterian who's a member of the Orange Order and is refusing to move to the Irish? Is that, again, pardon my ignorance and educate me, I'm not sure of his background, but is that not a United Ireland? A United Voice for Ireland includes people of all religion and none, does it not? I thought it did. Okay, Minister of State for International Development and Diaspora, Neil Richmond, is in Donegal today. He's attending the Tip O'Neill Irish Diaspora Awards this evening. Good morning to you, Neil. Thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Greg. Thanks for having me.
It's great to see how these awards have developed over the years to become, you know, a very important part of the Donegal calendar. But beyond that as well, recognising the amazing contribution of a wide sort of diverse group of people.
It's an amazing achievement to see how these awards that started in 2012 are now a centre point of the calendar for the entire global Irish community. They really are such an exciting event, and obviously named after the great Tip O'Neill, and I'm delighted that his son Tom O'Neill will be in attendance tonight. But if I have a second, I might just go through the four amazing people who will be receiving the awards tonight. First is Vincent Keaveney, who's originally from Dublin but with deep Donegal connections. He was the first ever Irish-born Lord Mayor of the City of London. And then we've Danny Hutton from Buncrana, who's the lead vocalist with the rock band Three Dog Night, who've had huge success in the US. And then we've Eileen and Sean Donaghy, who are from Buncrana but have established over 30 years an amazing restaurant in Sydney called Mulligan's, but also they're just at the heart of the community. And why I list them out like that is all four people have come from very different backgrounds and are active in three very different countries, but they're so proud of not just their Irish roots, but particularly their Donegal roots, and they really represent the best of the Irish abroad. So to celebrate them tonight in Buncrana is a really, really timely, and it's a huge honour for me as Minister for the Diaspora to be here, to be in Donegal today, and indeed to be presenting these awards.
Of course, we're 1 week out from the presidential election, and it would be remiss of you to not use the opportunity to canvass up here. I think you'll be out with Senator Manus Boyle and Nikki Bradley, for Heath Humphreys, obviously. The latest poll, and we do know the only poll that matters is the poll next week, right? But the latest poll shows that Catherine Connolly has a very substantial lead over your candidate, Heather Humphreys. Do you believe that's a gap that can be closed between now and next Friday?
Absolutely. The current gap in the polls is the exact same gap that Sean Gallagher had over Michael D. Higgins a week out from the 2011 presidential election. And I think we all know how that ended up. And we've been very lucky for the last 14 years to have Michael D. Higgins as our president. And I fundamentally believe that we have a good week, literally a week today. And first thing I would say to your listeners, Greg, is the most important thing they do is to vote, regardless of who they vote for. But I am going to be canvassing day and night for a great Ulster woman and a good friend of mine in the former Heather Humphreys.
Why do you believe she is the right person for the job?
Well, I think I say this as someone who is a Minister of State in the Department of Foreign Affairs, we're in really, really tricky, difficult global times at the moment. We need our allies. We need our friends. Heather has a proven record as a Minister, TD and Councillor of being able to work with people from all backgrounds, not only on this island, but across the world. And I know she's not on to defend herself, but I think we all know that the opinions that Ms. Connolly has are extremely worrying. And even today, with a very worrying militant leader in her visit, taxpayer paid visit to Syria.
But you talk about how the role of diplomacy, was it not Simon Harris that called President Trump a gowl, probably one of the economies we're most reliable on? I mean, that's not fantastic diplomatic language to be using, is it?
Well, I think there's a big difference in diplomatic language in making a comment in relation to President America than meeting a militant leader in Syria, or indeed referring to the German preparations of security and comparing it to the Nazis, or indeed voting consistently against EU treaties, or indeed constantly chastising our European allies for very sincerely and deliberately preparing themselves against Russian
but
aggression.
The problem,
I think
the problem
not
that
the
you,
right to equate the two as the same.
No, I understand that, but I was more of a reference not to her trip to Syria, but the diplomatic role the president pays. But you see the things that you are sort of attacking in inverted commas, and I know it's not mean-spirited, Catherine Connolly, there are the things that a lot of people are going to vote. If you're going to have any success for her, because they agree with her, if you're going to have any success over the next week, the things that you're talking, a lot of people agree with the, I think it was a clumsy sort of analogy with Nazi Germany, but in terms of what was happening in terms of time, it's similar, right? a lot of people are concerned about the way Europe is spending in terms of, you know, moving towards a European army or whatever it might be. A lot of people are critical, if you're in the fishing or farming industry, of the role of the EU. You know, the very things that you sort of are having a go at Catherine Connolly about are the very things that perhaps people might be inclined to vote for her about. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I can see what you're getting at. And I fully understand anyone who has concerns about real life issues that are impacting them. But I don't think it's clumsy making a comparison with Nazi Germany. It was very deliberate and it follows a consistent 10 to 15 year record. But what the point I'm very clearly making is that Europe has been good for Ireland. It has been good for our farming community. It will continue to be good for our farming community. And Heather Humphreys is a pro-European candidate, consistently so. Yeah. And what I really want to be able to hear and see from my president is a president that knows that they represent the country not only at home but also abroad and can do so consistently, something that Heather has done as a minister repeatedly.
I think it'd be interesting if you asked Senator Manaspol, with whom you're actually canvassing today, if you ask him if he thinks Europe has been good for the fishing industry. Because I don't think he would say it, has.
I've spoken to Manus about that consistently. Manus had me in Killybegs about 13 months ago before the local elections, and I've had him in Brussels on two occasions, and we've worked very closely with Nina Carberry, and we've got a number of carve-outs for Irish fishers, and I know that's of acute interest in Donegal, but it's also of acute interest in West Cork and Wexford and other areas, and we have consistently seen, and where I would have got to know Manus was before his own political entry when his dad was still a councillor, working on making sure that we protect Irish fishers from the real impact of Brexit, something that was an achievement. When we needed Europe in the Brexit negotiations, and you and I discussed at length the impact for border communities so many times of various proposals from the then British government, Europe stood with us. And you know who was a cabinet minister at the time making sure that Europe stood with us? Heather Humphreys.
All right, okay, well, we'll leave it on that note. Listen, enjoy your stay, enjoy tonight. I would love to have gone, but I have another appointment. Enjoy tonight. It's a wonderful thing, and it's great. It's been amazing to see how it's grown. So, and it's also actually very good that you're there as well, actually, because it does give it an extra bit of recognition. But thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much.
Okay, take care of yourself. That's Minister for the Diaspora, Minister Neil Richmond. Now, I'm in studio with David McCourt, who's chair of the National Broadband Ireland. It's the company delivering the new future-proofed high-speed fibre to the home network under the National Broadband Plan. On behalf of the government, 500 Donegal premises on Arran Mór can now avail of high-speed fibre broadband connection. Thanks so much for joining us, David.
Greg, it's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
How are we doing sort of in this region overall then? Obviously, it's very welcome that our island community is being serviced, as they are. How are we doing in terms of reaching targets?
Well, 75% of Donegal is wired and ready. So it's almost done. In the whole country, of the 560,000 homes, 450,000 are done. So the project will be done next year. It'll be done ahead of schedule, under budget. And I believe it's delivering the policy it was intended to.
What's left in Donegal? Is it the more tricky connections?
Yeah, the beginning and the end are always the hardest. It's, Greg, that's just the way construction works. The getting it started is hard and finishing it is hard. But it's only months away from being 100% done. So now we just need people to hook it up and figure out how to use that fiber to see if they can do things to change their life and change the way they not only communicate, but the way they educate their kids, the way they deal with healthcare, the way they deal with... Everything is moving away from copper and into a world where if you have fiber, you can change the way you educate your kids, you can change the way you deal with healthcare, you can change the way you work, obviously, as well as entertainment, obviously, Greg.
Yeah. So how the remaining 25%, you say that will be, when will that 25% be connected in Donegal?
The next few months.
Okay. And how can you accelerate so quickly?
Well,
if you know what I mean, if it's taken now to get to 75%, how can we close that?
Well, you know, we had the whole country. We're working in every county in the country. So we had the whole country to deal with, and we put enough fiber to go around the world four times, and we've covered 96% of the landmass in Ireland. So it was a massive project. It was a massive multi-billion-dollar public-private partnership. And to put it in perspective, there was a professor, Flyberg, in Oxford that did a study a few years ago, and he measured 16,000 public-private partnerships across 190 countries, and he found out that only half of 1% can tick off three boxes: on time, on budget, and deliver policy. So this project is on time, under budget, and delivering policy. And that's because the government was brave to do it. The department has worked very, very hard to execute on it. And the men and women of NBI have just worked tirelessly. So all three, the private sector, the public sector, the government, the department, everybody's worked together to make it happen.
I mean, there was an initial carving out, wasn't there, if I could phrase it like that, of what would be delivered privately and what might be delivered through this plan. And if I remember correctly, then very close to, or whilst the plan was upgoing, there's a further bit of cherry picking, if I could put it to you like that, where the easier connections, you could argue, were carved out. Was that problematic at all? Is that just part of the process?
You mean they were carved out by the private sector ahead
of time? That's correct, yes.
Yeah, I think that was done probably to try to, whatever company did that was probably doing it to help themselves, and it wasn't really the best in the best interest of the state. It didn't make the project easier. It made it more difficult, and it was done for someone else's, you know, for their own self-interest. And it made it a little bit more difficult to get the project off the ground, but we persevered. We got it off the ground. And it's the only country, and we all should be proud, as Irishmen and women, we all should be proud. It's the only country in Europe that's leaving no one behind. Mm-hmm. Everyone has the right to fiber now. And fiber, Greg, when you think of fiber, you really shouldn't think of Netflix or Amazon or, you know, just streaming video. You should think about everything that's going to come down the road, how people are going to be educated, how healthcare is going to be delivered, how you're going to work. And with AI, which works so much better if you have a fiber connection because it's so robust and how much capacity it needs, everything is going to change. And Ireland will be very happy that they made the decision, I think, to wire the whole country.
I mean, there are packages, you know, now 500 megabyte, 1,000 megabyte, right? What is the capacity of the network?
Basically,
broadly speaking, if you know.
Broadly speaking, it's unlimited. We had to build it contractually. We had to make it what's in the contract called future-proof. So we have to constantly use our own capital to continually to upgrade it to make sure that it can handle whatever product or services the market brings to bear. So as people come up with new ideas to use fiber to change, whether it's a societal problem or to deliver a product, we have to upgrade the network to deliver that. Mm. And we're trying to encourage people to come up with ideas. We're up here actually to give a grant to the National School up in Dumfries to buy some handheld tablets for the kids to help them with their reading. And that's our 160th grant. And we give these grants to anybody that will use the fiber to figure out how to either create a job or help educate kids or help a social enterprise deliver their service. And we're trying to encourage people to come up with interesting ideas. And we've had young people especially come up with amazing ideas of how to use that fiber to either create dignified jobs or accelerate a social service. It's been great.
Mm. So it's unlimited. So a 10,000 or a offering is doable if now I think a lot of people would struggle for a device in their home that would be able to sort of max out the 1,000. But anyway, we are progressing all of the time. Quick, just because you're in this sector, a question about AI. I was on the record on this show a couple of years ago thinking that, and this was only from my own personal perspective, that I had a side of, outside maybe of the sort of business applications and what have you, that, you know, we're in a bit of an AI bubble in terms of how it actually will go on to have a positive impact on our lives, okay? And part of that's motivated by the fact that even the big companies like ChatGPT or Grok, for an example, they're demonstrating its power by the creation of videos, which reminds me of when Siri first came out and you'd ask Siri the time, because you didn't really have much else to ask it, right? So the cool thing was it was able to tell you the time. And I just wonder, do you have any sort of an insight or any vision as to, in everyday life, where artificial intelligence will become, you know, adopted and a part of the norm? Because I do have my, as a user, as a, my reservations about it.
That's a very interesting question, Greg. I would be on the side of being very pro that AI, obviously there's problems it could create if it got out of control, but AI is going to change everything. Going to change everything about the way we live, in everything about the way we interact, in everything about the way we work. I think it's
how do you think it will affect people? I just think in everyday life, for it to be commercially successful, and you know, I just think of when Sky took out 3D glasses, and they were trying to put 3D TVs in pubs, and the whole notion was that everyone in the pub would stand with wearing these 3D glasses, right? There was a few of them around here. And I'm not saying it's in the same level. I'm on about the sort of the... I think it had to be broadly adopted, really, for it to be truly worth all the money that's going into it. But how do you think you and I at home or in our day-to-day lives will engage with it?
Well, I mean, the whole experience of, on the entertainment side, the whole experience of watching TV will be replaced by immersive, where you feel like you're actually in the show. So you will be, all of entertainment is moving towards immersive. Mm. And you're seeing these immersive centers opening up all over the world. They're opening up. It's the fastest growing piece of the entertainment ecosystem right now.
Do you think it will catch on?
Pardon me?
Do you think it will catch on at that length? Because, I mean, like, smart glasses haven't really landed.
Smart glasses.
Virtual reality. Billions have been put into it and people aren't, it's not heavily adopted.
Yeah, but all these technologies
I'm just concerned that people actually genuinely don't like necessarily being out of the reality space.
Well, that's a generational thing. We grew up a certain way. But think about, Greg, think about the internet for a minute. The internet was invented in the mid-70s. It wasn't in the Telecom Act of 97, which was the biggest piece of legislation at the time America ever had, the Telecom Act that broke up AT&T. At that time, AT&T was the most profitable company on the planet. That Telecom Act only mentioned the word internet twice, and both were in irrelevant sections. So 20 years after it was invented, the government didn't even understand what it was,
yeah.
And nobody was using it.
Mm.
Now, everyone knows what it is and everyone's using it. So it takes a long time because it's a generational
thing. Just that we saw things stubble like mini discs, you know, and things. So, but you're very, very much correct, I'm sure. Just in relation to broadband as a whole and going back maybe to the carving out or what have you, there are people listening to this show now, right, who got their internet, maybe not through the MBP, and, you know, they've been promised fibre. They're getting, you know, 62 download, 70 download, 25 download, right, through a company, right? And they're the ones that have put in the infrastructure. What there is a minimum, isn't there, speed delivery from the National Broadband Plan, right?
Correct.
So what then, and it's a two-part question, if not three. Yeah. So what about people then that find themselves feeling disadvantaged, that they're on fibre, they're maxing out at 62 in this one listener's case, and someone up the road's on the NBP with potentially unlimited download speeds.
So in your question, you're saying that someone is on fiber but not on the MBP.
Yeah, and I'm trying not to mention companies because I don't know like Air, for instance, right? Okay, so Air are responsible for some of their own infrastructure, I presume.
But at that speed, I doubt they're on fiber. Yeah. Fiber in the ecosystem.
Yeah.
So salesperson might have said they're on fiber.
Could they be on sort of copper from the pole?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And look, the copper's going away. There's all
over. Yeah, but if you're on private property, right, and you're running the copper from the pole to your house.
Yep. That copper's going to go away.
Yeah, but who's going to get rid of that?
Well, it has to go. In Europe, it's supposed to all be gone by 2030. It won't be. But all of Europe is supposed to remove the copper and be replaced by fiber because if that copper is, it's a diminishing asset because it also causes, it's so heavy that whenever there was a storm, like that last big storm that came through here, it's so heavy that it brings down the poles. And when you bring down one pole, it usually brings down the second, third. So the copper switch off is happening, just like the analog switch off happened on the TVs, right? And some countries in Northern Europe have already done it. Ireland's a little behind, maybe a lot behind. And that copper needs to be removed from the system so everyone has the same access. So in that case, those two people, you know, 100 meters down the street from each other, both will have the same access to the same capabilities.
There's an awful lot of stuff can impact on speed too as well. How much of your package you achieve, you know, you're rebooting your router for crying out loud. There's an awful, like what you might be getting at the pole versus what you're enjoying in the house can be very different things. There's a lot of variables there.
Well,
that aren't necessarily the responsible of the infrastructure.
Well, in the case of MBP, there's two things in a contract that are very interesting. We can speed test, and the government can speed test our network. So we have to deliver the best speed in the country. We have no choice. And the government can, there's devices on our network where the government can actually see what we're delivering. And there's 50 retail providers. So if someone is on the MBP and they're not, and they can find out where they are, they can just go on nbi.ie and they can put their postcode in, the air code, and they can see whether they're on it. If they're on it, there's 50 different retail providers. If they're not happy with one, because they should move to another, because we're not a retail provider.
You're an infrastructure.
And we don't have all the retail providers, they're all treated equally. So if they're not happy with one, they should just go to another one.
Okay. The Tip O'Neill Awards are on tonight, four fantastic recipients again. And, you know, you think each year can't be matched, and yet here we are recognising more amazing people. You collected this award yourself recently. What did it mean to you?
Oh, it was a great honor. It was a great honor because, first of all, it's a lovely evening, and they put on a lovely event. But it was a great honor, first and foremost, because Tip O'Neill was my first real boss. I worked for him when I was in university, so he taught me a lot of things. His son, Tom, who will be there tonight, is a dear friend of mine. And we're going from here to that national school in Dumfries to give a grant. And that school is where Tom's great-grandmother went to school. So it's, and this is where the family.
It's a tiny wee country we live in, isn't it? Let alone the county.
It was a great honor. And it was an emotional day for me because it was, you know, I remember when I gave my comments after I got the award, I was talking about the horrors in Gaza. And I know you have a nurse coming on later on today, that, and God love him for spending time over there helping those poor people. And we're a year on in that devastation over there and the killing. It's just amazing that how bad that is. But it was...
And to put it into context, how many lives have been lost or destroyed in between our two conversations?
It's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable, isn't it?
And unnecessary. Mm. And it's unnecessary. And, you know, and those that started now are being applauded for ending it, which is sort of a weird sort of way to look at the world, isn't it?
Mm. Unfortunately, though, it is sort of the way of the world. David, it's great to see you again. We spoke remotely the last time. It's great to have you. It's great to have you in situ here, chatting to us. Enjoy tonight, and enjoy today. It's great for Dumfries School to be getting a grant as well. That's through the
Rise Foundation,
MBI, isn't it?
Well, Rise is a foundation I started up, Greg, and I started it in Tom O'Neill, his wife Shelley, and my wife. They're all on the board. And it's a foundation we started to help people in rural Ireland use technology to deliver social services or create dignified jobs. And it's the Rise Foundation that NBI supports that'll be given that grant.
Excellent. All right, listen, great to have you in. Thanks for the update.
Anytime you're looking for someone, I'll be glad
to come. All right, David, thanks so much. That's David McCord, who is the chair of National Broadband Ireland, who said there in the coming months, the remaining 25%. Is it all done? Sorry, this is one question I meant to ask. It's all done wired, isn't it? Do you use any sort of, you know, deflector, satellite systems?
It's all fiber.
All fiber. Okay. Yeah. All right. Good stuff. And thanks very much.
A lot of it.
How many times around the world?
4 times around the world.
My word. Okay. Back after these. In studio with me now is Jason O'Connor. He's a nurse with PANSMA, the Palestinian, Australian and New Zealand Medical Association. And earlier this year, Jason went to Gaza as part of the PANSMA to bring medical aid to the people of Palestine. And he joins me in studio now. Jason, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Greg. Hello.
So you actually got into Gaza. When was that?
It was the end of April, and then I was basically there for pretty much the whole of May.
Describe it to us.
It's indescribable, yeah, to be honest with you. It's like a complete moonscape. There's literally not a building or a road that is not destroyed or has some level of, destruction, windows smashed, heavy artillery shell, like pockmarks. It's just...
What was your engagement with the people like? What was their existence?
Their existence is awful, to be honest with you. When I was there, it was probably...
Can I ask you to move a little closer? You're quite softly spoken, which is nice.
Sorry,
don't get me wrong.
Sorry.
It's just I want everyone to hear what you're saying.
Yeah, no, that's okay. Their existence is just so bad, to be honest with you. I was there probably pushing 2 months into the blockade. By that stage... Like food was quite scarce. The staff that I was working with were barely getting, a meal a day. The organisation that I went in with provided us with a meal in the evenings. And then when we went into Gaza, myself and the 3 doctors, we were actually able to bring some of our own supplies in with us, but it was restricted by weight, so... It was a matter of bringing in, stuff that was,
But you were restricted in what you could bring in.
Yeah.
How is that exercise, that restriction?
Well, to be honest with you, everything that gets in and out of Gaza is observed by the Israelis. So our baggage was checked 3 times at least before we actually even got into
To the point whereby this is not to make sure you've got a hand grenade or a gun.
No.
This is food, right? So you deem to have too much food, that food is taken from you.
That would have been confiscated, yes. And any medication that we would have taken in that was, say, not ours or deemed in excess, they would have confiscated.
What do you believe, if you can put yourself in this brain space, would be the motivation for restricting how much medicine and food, demonstrably, medicine and food could go into a region?
Well, without getting political, because I was wanting to keep this as my experience, kind of...
Unfortunately, this has to fall
apart. No, I realise that. To be honest with you, if we're going to go down that route, what has gone on in Gaza has been, from what I can see and my experience here, has been planned. What they've targeted, what they've restricted in and out, is all designed to keep the Palestinian people and the Gazan people on the barest minimum of food.
Did you see a Hamas presence there when you were in there? You were in Al Shifa Hospital which was effectively described as a base for Hamas. But did they have any influence on you or interaction with you over there?
None whatsoever. My interaction. The reason I ended up in Shifa ICU primarily was because I have some experience in coronary care in Letterkenny here. So I would be, well enough versed in looking after sick patients. We would have had patients transferred in and out of ICU with myself in CCU here. But when I went into Shifa, it was a case of the most nurses that I'd come across there that could speak English, because I speak literally no Arabic. Mm-hmm. The most nurses that I came across that were able to speak and speak well in English were in the intensive care unit. So that's where I got
did you
placed.
Get a, did you get a set, like, did people try and get on with their lives? If you know what I mean, as impossible as that might seem, right? Because yeah. the place is in, it's ruined. Mm. Obviously, the noises, the starvation, the illness, the general stuff that's unimaginable. Mm. But did locals try and find a way to have some semblance of a normality even in that situation?
They did, and to be fair to them, Greg, to be honest with you, I've actually visited quite a lot of countries in the world throughout my years, and what they are subjected to and how they still function is just absolutely mind-blowing. They have literally nothing there, and on my final days when I was coming away, they were actually bringing me gifts. You know, myself and the doctors that I went in with over the last week or 10 days, we realised that, you know, our time was coming to an end there and we would be exiting. So we literally gave all of our food away, all of our excess medication, clothing. Literally, we left with nothing but the clothes that we were wearing.
Yeah.
And the people were bringing me gifts.
Yeah,
as I'm leaving, you know.
Those that, you know, started, promoted, facilitated the war, and now those that are sort of claiming the peace, so to speak, putting that to one side, what do you think for the future? The killing seems to have stopped. I'm not saying it's not happening and there aren't isolated instances, and there seems to be some sort of internal struggles in Gaza now as well, which is, again, as soon as the people of Gaza feel maybe there's a breather, you know, you start seeing sort of infighting to some extent. But how hopeful are you of for the future, finally, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, if I'm being bluntly honest, I wouldn't be too hopeful. Every ceasefire, if you look back through history, every ceasefire that the Israelis have entered into, they've never actually managed to stick to. I was in contact with nursing staff there as recently as the day before yesterday, like video calling, and they were displaced to the south and have returned to Gaza City in the last week, 10 days, and they've got absolutely nothing to come back to. So the sheer...
Where do you start? Like,
absolutely.
Where do you
sheer
start?
Building project. Yeah. I mean, we're
even
going...
clearing unexploded ordnance and rubble. Where do you blooming start?
Yeah. Well, I mean, even something... I was going to see about beginning some sort of fundraising effort myself soon, because even it's going into their winter there now, and even things like tents or shelter, because they have no homes basically left in most instances.
Okay.
They've got shelters or tents that are not fit for purpose. Yeah. You know,
I'm sure if you're organising anything locally, we'll hear about it. Do you intend to return?
To be honest with you, that's why I was so quiet about my experience for this long, because I had intended to go back and I didn't want to go anywhere or say anything or do anything that would jeopardise that. I did recently speak to PANSMA again about going back in, but the Ministry of Health in Gaza and the UN are so desperately in need of medical staff, that the nursing staff have kind of been put on the back burner. But as soon as I get another chance to go in, much to my poor wife's chagrin, I will probably take the chance.
All right, Jason, listen, thanks for calling in for a chat. I mean, obviously it's such an expansive topic and we had 15 minutes, but we covered quite a bit there and got a sense of the reality from your perspective of being there. Thank you so much for calling
in. No problem. You're welcome.